I'll be talking about work done in collaboration with, let's see how to work this, Shumit Das and Sachin Vaidya. Sachin is now at UC Davis. Well, we are getting used to the idea in string theory that in many cases, moving objects grow in transverse size. This is an idea that has been suggested by intuitively thinking about how information might spread near a black hole horizon. It is supported by the string uncertainty principle and is a feature of non-commutative field theories, several of which arise as limits of string theory. I should cross over. In this talk, I'd like to explore this idea in the context of a phenomenon which is now called the giant graviton phenomenon. This refers to the fact that massless particles in supergravity, when moving in appropriate external fields, often expand or blow up into higher dimensional brains. We'll see that in some cases, the giant graviton phenomena lends itself quantitatively to a fairly precise analysis and therefore provides us a good laboratory in which to study this growth in transverse size. In the cases where we will be able to understand things quantitatively, this behavior will be related, the behavior of gravitons, more precisely zero brains blowing up, will be related to a magnetic analog of an effect which was first studied by Rob Myers and is now called the dielectric effect. So to begin with, I'll tell you what the magnetic counterpart is of the dielectric effect. Then we'll quickly go over the giant graviton story in case some of you are not familiar with it. In part three of the talk, we'll put these two things together, and I'll describe one situation involving zero brains moving in a four-brain background, in which the zero brains will then blow up, puff up, into a D2 brain, and we'll see that the properties of the resulting expanded brain can be calculated equally well, energy, radius, and so on, from the two-brain picture and the zero-brain picture. Now, the dielectric effect or its magnetic counterpart per se have very little to do with supersymmetry. On the other hand, the discussion of giant gravitons, when it was first carried out in the literature, was done in context with a lot of supersymmetry and conformal invariance. So prompted by part three of this talk, we'll then seek and find many examples of the giant graviton phenomenon with less or even no supersymmetry and no conformal invariance. Two references before I get underway, which provide an important backdrop for this talk. One is a paper by McGreevy, Susskind, and Tumbas, where the giant graviton phenomena was first discussed, and then the paper of Rob Myers, which I just mentioned, dielectric brains. Okay, so very quickly, let me review the dielectric effect. What Myers, Ramsdonk, and Taylor showed us was that brains can couple to higher form Ramon-Ramon fields. For example, zero brains can couple to a three-form Ramon-Ramon field. So if you take some simple situation where the corresponding four-form field strength is a constant, that means you get a coupling which is linear in the four-form field strength and involves three of the transverse scalars. Now, that means in turn, if you look at the energy for a static configuration of n brains, then it has the following terms. This is just the number of zero brains, the mass of zero brains. This is the familiar quartic coupling, and this is the additional coupling to the Ramon-Ramon field. I'm restricting myself here to couplings, to terms up to quartic order. And this is because when you go to higher orders, this is because the non-abelian action here will be crucial for our discussion. And when one goes to higher orders, there are some ambiguities in that action, which I don't want to get into. Similarly, when we talk about moving brains, I'll restrict myself to a Lagrangian, which involves only two derivative terms, only velocity square terms, rather, and no acceleration terms. Okay, so let's just look at some simple situation where the background four-form field strength is then a constant of this form. It's non-zero if I, J, and K are in one, two, and three directions, appropriately anti-symmetrized, and zero otherwise, and ask what are the solutions which minimize the energy. And the answer is that the solutions are of this form. xi is proportional to ji for I equals 1, 2, and 3, the three directions where the field, the background field is non-zero, where ji here stands for an n-dimensional representation of SU2. And this was the configuration which also appeared in Rob Myers' previous talk, and it goes by the name of a fuzzy sphere. It's fuzzy because you can't simultaneously diagonalize the three coordinates, so you can't associate a definite location with each zero grain, but you can associate a definite radius because the sum of the squares of these three coordinates is in fact a multiple of the identity. And that radius then turns out to be proportional to the background field and also the number of zero grains. This is for an n-dimensional irreducible representation. Now there's another configuration with exactly the same quantum numbers, which involves a two-brain wrapping a two-sphere with n units of magnetic flux turned on. The n units of magnetic flux give the required amount of zero-brain charge. The energy of this configuration can be written down. It comes from the dBi term and the Chern-Simons term. If you look at this energy in the limit where the zero-brain flux dominates the energy, then you get three terms just from expanding that energy out, which are these. And these terms are in one-to-one correspondence with the three terms I wrote down in the zero-brain description. We take this limit because it's in this limit, really, that you're justified in truncating the zero-brain action down to quartic terms, throwing away higher terms. So when the fact that you get these a one-to-one correspondence is already suggestive. Moreover, when you go ahead and compute then the energy and radius in the two-brain description, you find that it agrees exactly with the fuzzy two-sphere. So in short, one can regard the fuzzy two-sphere D0-brain configuration as providing an alternate, more microscopic, if you wish, description of the spherical two-brain. And this is the story which will get played out as we go along in other situations as well. Okay, so let's look at the magnetic counterpart of this. I won't go into this in too much detail, but a very similar argument tells you, for example, that if you have a constant four-form magnetic field strength now, you get a coupling in the Lagrangian of this kind, linear in that background field, this time involving four transverse coordinates. This is for a zero-brain configuration, except really three transverse coordinates and the velocity in the fourth transverse direction. The fact that the velocity appears is really not so surprising. Even a point particle, as we all know, couples to a magnetic field through a velocity-dependent interaction. More generally, if the background field is not constant, the coupling is of this form involving the gauge potential, which in general is some function of x, the transverse directions. Okay, so again, let's take a simple situation where this background field is now a constant, non-zero, when ij, k, and l are in the 1, 2, 3, 4 directions and 0 otherwise. The Lagrangian now has these four terms in it. This is just, again, the mass of zero brains, kinetic energy term, quartic coupling, and the extra coupling to the magnetic field. And ask what are the resulting solutions, and they are as follows. Let's choose the brains move in one direction, which we just choose by convention to be the fourth direction. One of these four directions move in that direction under overall center or mass motion, and moreover move with uniform velocity. So that's this term here. And then in the remaining three transverse directions, they swell up, puff up, if you wish, into a fuzzy two-sphere. Okay, that's why this ji n-dimensional representations of SU2 show up. The radius of this fuzzy two-sphere, as you can see, is actually velocity dependent, so besides being dependent on the background field and the number of zero brains. Okay, so in short, we actually get a one-parameter family of solutions labeled by velocity, and this then is a good example of growth in transverse size because that radius, if you remember, was just, in fact, linearly dependent on the velocity. More generally dependent on the momentum as well. And this is the intuitive picture. You have the zero brains barreling down in the fourth direction and having swollen up in the remaining directions. Of course, I hasten to add, there's no violation of Lorentz invariance here. There is a preferred frame in which the background field is purely magnetic, and it's the velocity with respect to that frame which counts in determining the transverse size. Again, there is another solution involving a two-brain with the same quantum numbers. So a magnetic field turned on and the two-brain wrapped on a spherical in a sphere. And this two-brain, again, has in the appropriate limit, which turns out to be a non-relativistic limit and so on, gives exactly the same energy and radius as the puffed-up zero-brain configuration we just talked about. Okay, so much for the magnetic counterpart of the dielectric effect. Now let's review quickly the giant graviton story And in particular, I'll focus on one case, which is the near horizon region of an M5 brain that is, in fact, ADS7 cross S4. I'll work in Poincaré coordinates here because we'll generalize this story later on to other DP brains. And these are convenient coordinates in which to think about that. So this is ADS7 cross S4. There's a transverse foresphere here of constant radius. The size of that radius is determined by the number of fibrins. And this is the ADS7 metric. One more thing I should add here, which is that there's a four-form field under which the fibrins are magnetically charged. And you can think of this four-form field strength of M theory then threading the S4. Okay. So now let's think about a massless particle which carries some angular momentum, rotates on the S4, and moves in this geometry. It's very easy to show just from the fact that P mu is zero, that it has an energy in terms of the angular momentum, P phi, and the radial momentum given by this. Now, what the authors showed, what McGreevy, Tumbas, and Susskind showed, was a rather interesting fact that, in fact, there is another solution consisting of a two-brain wrapping a two-sphere, which belongs to this, which is a subset of the four-sphere, and also rotating on the four-sphere, which, in fact, carries the same energy as a massless particle. And that sounds a bit counterintuitive at first, because you think it should cost more energy to rotate a massive object with the same angular momentum as opposed to a massless particle. And we'll come back to that in a moment and see why that expectation is not correct. But before that, let me describe the two-brain solution they found in some more detail. So here's, and I'll do it in a very pedestrian way. Let's choose explicit coordinates on the four-sphere, so five coordinates, yis, which sum to one. So that's a coordinate system on the unit four-sphere. And instead, actually change variables and go to new coordinates, which are rho, phi, theta, and psi. The details are not important, except to remember that when theta and psi parameterize a two-sphere, because if you only vary theta and psi, keep rho and phi fixed. You're moving on a two-sphere of radius given by y3 squared plus y4 squared plus y5 squared, which happens to be equal to rho squared. So this is a two-sphere. And what we'll do is take the M2 brain to wrap this two-sphere. That means, in addition, then it can move in the rho direction, in the phi direction. And of course, it can fall in or out in this gravitational field along the radial direction. Okay, so that's the kind of solution we'll seek. And with that ansatz, we put it into the action, which has two terms, the Born-Enfield term and the Chern-Simons term. Now, there is a Chern-Simons coupling because the two brain is, of course, charged under the three-form gauge potential. And I just told you that the four-form field strength is excited. So that's why you get this coupling here. It's very similar to how a point particle couples to a magnetic field. And not surprisingly, the strength of that coupling depends on the number of fibrins and is also dependent on the velocity in the phi direction, excuse me. OK, so it turns out to be very convenient to think about the system in the Hamiltonian language, which can be very easily derived. Here's what you get. It's very easy to understand this Hamiltonian. The first term here is simply the mass of the two brain. Since you're wrapping it on a two-sphere proportional to the tension, this second and third term arise simply because of moving in the rho and the r directions. And this last term here comes from rotating in the phi direction, except you see it's not just proportional to the angular momentum in the phi direction, but rather that minus this term. That's something which is familiar to us. If you have a particle moving in a magnetic field, the energy depends not on the momentum, but the velocity square, through a P minus EA coupling. And it's exactly the same thing which gives rise to this coupling here. The extra piece here comes simply from the Chern-Simons term. And now we can actually see how it might be that a massive object, an expanded brain, might actually cost the same amount of energy as a massless particle. This term does indeed cost more in energy, as we would have expected. But here, for some fixed angular momentum, it in fact costs less energy than if you had an uncharged particle rotating, because you have this part subtracted away. If things are just right, these two effects can compete with each other and cancel, giving rise to the same energy as a massless particle. And that's, in fact, exactly what happens. The condition for the two effects to cancel turns out to be one which relates the radius of the four-sphere to the number of fibrins. R enters here. It also enters in G phi, N5 enters here. And if this is true, and it turns out to be true for ADS7 cross S4, then, in fact, one can conveniently write the Hamiltonian as a sum of perfect squares, four terms. And when one does that, one can see that there are special solutions which minimize the energy for some fixed angular momentum, where you sit at the minimum of the potential as far as the rho direction is concerned. So this term can be set equal to 0 by choosing rho to be p phi over n. And then since you have the minimum of the potential, you can also set the momentum in the rho direction to be 0. These two terms then just disappear, and you're left with exactly the energy for a massless particle. Okay? So these are, as I said, special solutions which minimize the energy. And for them, for some fixed angular momentum, you get the same energy as a massless particle. Now, these solutions have some special properties, as one might expect. Since rho is bounded by 1, there's a maximum angular momentum for which these solutions exist. In general, a bound that p phi must be less than or equal to the number of fibrains, and this, in fact, agrees with the stringy exclusion principle. In fact, these states have been shown to be BPS states by these people. And all this leads to the following intuitive picture, that if you start with a graviton first, which is rotating slowly, and you spin it up, add more and more angular momentum, that the back reaction and so on builds up, and it turns into, in fact, an expanded brain. And what we'd like to now do is ask if we can understand that in some more quantitative detail. Okay, so can we do this? It turns out to be a little difficult to do directly, but then we remember the basic lesson of matrix theory, which is that processes simplify when we choose a particular direction, say the M direction, and boost everything in that direction. And so let's do that. We'll choose one direction parallel to the fibrain, which will be the M direction, add N units to the of momentum along that direction to the system, and then look at it. So what does it look like? And also, I should say, at least for now, although if time permits, we'll come back to this again later. For now, I'll just put all those N units of momentum onto the graviton. We could have also put some of it onto the D brain, onto the phi brain, which will now turn into the D4 brain. And if time permits, I'll come back to that story. But for now, let's just put it all onto the graviton. So what happens? Let's look at everything in the 2A picture. The phi brain turns into a 4 brain. The graviton turns into, since we have boosted it now, turns into N0, D0 brains. We saw that we developed a picture of the graviton turning into a 2 brain, M2 brain. And now, of course, the 2 brain also we expect to be boosted along this M direction. And that, therefore, then will correspond to a D2 brain with N0 units of magnetic flux turned on in its whirl volume. And the question becomes, can we understand the resulting D2 brain as a puffed up configuration of D0 brains? Okay, so now the 2 brain we have analyzed already in some detail. The only change once we boost it is that you get an extra term in its energy just corresponding to the momentum in the M direction. And in 2A units, which is what I'm using here, that extra piece is simply the mass of N0, D0 brains, as you'd expect. These are just the pieces we are familiar with already. And I'm writing the energy down here, of course, for those special solutions we talked about. What about 0 brains? Well, to talk about the 0 brains, which are moving in this curved geometry with also the appropriate Ramon-Ramon field turned on, we really need to understand the non-abelian action in curved space and so on. And that action, in general, is problematic. It's ambiguous due to ordering problems. Here I've written it down. There's a DBI term and a Chern-Simons term. For example, the DBI term depends on the dilaton and the various components of the metric, all of which, in turn, in this curved background, are functions of the transverse coordinates. Likewise, the Chern-Simons term depends on this Ramon-Ramon field, the three-form gauge potential, which again is a function of the transverse coordinates. And these coordinates are, of course, all n by n matrices. So there's an ordering issue here which we need to settle. Well, luckily for us, we are seeking a particular kind of solution. We already know what the 2-brain looks like. And the solution we are seeking suggests a particular ansatz that I'll describe for you in a moment. And once you put that ansatz in fact, this ordering ambiguity disappears, and we can interpret the Lagrangian in an unambiguous way. So let me just very quickly tell you how that happens. Here is the 4-brain metric in 2A units. H is a harmonic function here. These are the 5 transverse directions. And again, we can describe these directions by changing coordinates and going over to the coordinates we used in our discussion before, where rho, phi, and 2 angles, theta and psi, which span the 2-sphere, are the 4 coordinates on the 4-sphere. Okay, so if we do that, we expect the 2-brain to be, in fact, wrapping the 2-sphere spanned by theta and psi. And then the corresponding 0-brain solution we seek, this suggests that the solution we seek is of the following form. All the directions except for the directions corresponding to the two-sphere are ones in which the zero brains just move under overall center of mass motion. So for example, in the x5 and x6 directions, it just moves under overall center of mass motion. And then in the directions corresponding to the two-sphere, the corresponding coordinates are in fact proportional to representations of the SU2 and therefore form a fuzzy sphere. Okay, so this is a natural ansatz to put in. When you put that ansatz in, one finds that okay, now the metric and dilaton and so on in this curved background depend on, in the coordinates I'm using, on r, the radial coordinate, and r times rho. And once you put this ansatz in, one finds that the sum of squares of these three transverse coordinates is r squared, rho squared times the multiple of the identity. Likewise, the sum over the five transverse coordinates is r squared times the identity. So in other words, the only times r and r times rho appear is when they are multiples of the identity. And therefore, they can really be treated as C numbers and pulled out of the Lagrangian. So that allows us then to interpret the DBI term in an unambiguous way. And similarly, one finds, I'll skip this discussion, that the Chern-Simons term can also be interpreted in an unambiguous fashion. So that really simplifies life. And once that is done, we then get a well-defined Lagrangian, which I write here, and a corresponding Hamiltonian for the special solutions here. I've set some terms corresponding to moving in rho and so on, zero, because we're seeking these special solutions. And we find, in fact, then, that the corresponding Hamiltonian, in fact, exactly agrees with the non-relativistic limit for the two-brain Hamiltonian we got, and the energy and radius and so on we get from both these pictures exactly agree. Okay, so so much for this case. Now, in the time that I have left, let me tell you about how the giant graviton story then can be extended to other cases. As I said, our discussion just now didn't particularly involve supersymmetry and so on. That prompts us to seek more examples of the giant graviton phenomenon. And here I'll discuss one obvious generalization, which is to look at brains moving now in a general D-brain background, not necessarily a background which is ADS across some sphere, but just a general D-brain background. So I'll call it choose my convention so that we start with a D6 minus P brain background. Now, one feature we had in our previous discussion was that we took a two brain moving in a five brain background. The two brain was the magnetic dual of the five brain, and that, of course, is crucial. So here we'll consider a P brain moving in the 6 minus P brain background. Okay, and here is the background then in Poincaré coordinates. It's got a SOP plus 3 rotational symmetry. Again, I can choose coordinates very similar to the ones I chose to describe a P plus 2 sphere here, this transverse P plus 2 sphere, rho and phi, and then some angles that span a P sphere. And we can then consider a DP brain which wraps this P sphere and also rotates on the P plus 2 sphere, and ask, when is it the case that there are special solutions for such a P brain which have the same energy for some fixed angular momentum as a massless particle? Okay, and so far, I should say, I've not made any restrictions like being in the near horizon limit or even working with an extremal black hole, a black brain. We will do a general analysis and then see when this turns out to be correct. So it's very easy to repeat the steps, and the dynamical variables, again, are the radial direction, rho and phi. And one gets a Hamiltonian then, which is a sum of four pieces, and in fact, so it's easy to put in this ansatz, and one finds that if an important condition is met again, okay, the Hamiltonian can be written as a sum of four perfect squares. So I'll come back to when this condition can be met, but let's assume it's true for a moment. This condition basically, again, relates the radius of the transverse P plus 2 sphere raised to some power to the number of 6 minus P brains giving rise to the background geometry. Very similar to what we had before. So we get a sum of four terms here. And again, there are special solutions where you sit at the minimum of the rho potential. You can set these two terms equal to zero. And then one finds exactly the same energy as massless particles. Okay. Now, I'll come back to that condition in a moment. But for now, let's note that, again, since rho is bounded by 1, there's a maximum value for which these solutions exist. And this maximum value then gives us a bound, which is the analog of the bound we got in the previous case due to the stringy exclusion principle. OK, so when is this condition met? It turns out if you have the D6 minus P brain geometry and you're in the near horizon extremal limit, OK, that means you throw away the 1 in the harmonic function. For the extremal geometry, the condition is indeed met. If you're in the near horizon and non-extremal geometry, OK, that's the analog of having a black hole in ADS space. Then, too, one finds, interestingly, that this condition is met. Finally, if you keep the full geometry, you keep the 1 in the harmonic function, this condition is not met. That's easy to see because this, as I said, is related to the radius of the P plus 2 sphere. So if you go sufficiently far, that, of course, grows with distance, and it's not a constant. So this condition is not met. Significantly, since the condition is met when we have a non-extremal geometry, we have this phenomenon of an expanded brain having the same energy as a massless particle working out even in situations with no supersymmetry. OK, so what is the significance of this condition? Well, it's not very clear to us at the moment, but there's one observation which is kind of interesting, and I just want to make it here, which is that if you ask what is the actual metric that the P brain sees, it's not really the string metric. There's a e to the minus phi factor, for example, which multiplies the Born-Enfield action. And that's one way to see that the real metric the P brain sees is conformally related to the string metric in this way. And then the condition we have, the important condition I just mentioned, actually says that the radius of the P plus 2 sphere in this metric, the P brain metric, should equal the number of 6 minus P brains. Now, it turns out that for an extremal near horizon geometry, for the 6 minus P brain, this metric, in fact, is ADS cross SP plus 2. Okay, so that takes some of the mystery away from why it actually worked. When you depart from extremality, the GTT and GRR components of the metric do change, but the transverse radius stays what it is in the extremal case, and that's why it continues to work in the non-extremal case as well. So as I said, this is not a particularly deep understanding, but it seems like an interesting observation. OK, so that more or less brings me to the end of my talk. I'll end with just a few additional things which are related and which might be fun to explore a little more. For example, there are at least a few other settings where this giant graviton story gets played out, which are somewhat more complicated. For example, one can consider next systems involving two kinds of brains giving rise to a background, so DP, DP prime systems. For example, a D0, D4 system. When we started with the five-brain case and we boosted it, I said I would put all the boost momentum into the graviton. But instead, if we had put it into the four-brain, we would get a system which had both four-brain charge and zero-brain charge, in other words, a D0, D4 brain system. And that has a metric of this kind now, depending on two harmonic functions corresponding to zero-brain and four-brain charge. There's a four torus. I've compactified these directions. So there's a four torus along which the four brain extends, but not the zero brain. And then there's a transverse four sphere, transverse to both the zero and four brains. Again, if you go to the near horizon limit, and let's say let me just discuss the extremal case for simplicity here. There are actually two kinds of brains one can consider. There is a two brain, which is magnetically dual to the four brain, a six brain, which is magnetically dual to the zero brain. So we can consider a two brain, which wraps the two sphere belonging to the four sphere and again rotates, or you can take a six brain, which wraps the four torus and also wraps a two sphere and also rotates. And in both those cases, again, one finds that there are special solutions which behave like massless particles. So there are at least several interesting cases where this whole story plays out. Now, I've shown you one example where we get a microscopic understanding of the phenomena, but by no means do we understand it in all cases, and it would be nice if there was some general uniform explanation in all these cases. OK, another thing that's kind of fun to think about a little might be have to do with holography. Polchinski and Strassler, for example, found in some cases supergravity duals to the dielectric effect that Myers discussed. And one could ask, what is the supergravity dual for the magnetic counterpart? Now, the magnetic counterpart is really obtained by doing an improper boost on the electric case. So there we had static brains in the electric case we just puffed up. Well, if you just change a frame, of course, that looks as if you have moving brains which are puffed up, except you can't quite turn an electric field into a completely magnetic one by doing a proper boost. But some analog of that, which is an improper boost, allows you to do that. So one might think that you can also obtain, similarly, a supergravity dual for the magnetic case by appropriately tinkering with the, for example, the kind of supergravity duals that Polchinski and Strassler found. I haven't quite completed it, but this would be fun to work out. Also, other fuzzy surfaces, some of them were studied in this paper. You could ask, what about other fuzzy surfaces? Well, there are other fuzzy spheres there, which are also fun to think about. But in other classes, just of fuzzy surfaces are other fuzzy cosets. For example, you can take the group SU3, and one can show that both CP2, which is SU3 mod U2, and SU3 mod U1 cross U1, which is a six-dimensional manifold, both of these, their fuzzy counterparts can be realized by turning on some appropriate external fields where the and puffing up the zero brains. And then one can ask, can one obtain these fuzzy cosets also in some interesting physical situation where the required fields, background fields, are generated in some consistent way, or another way where they might appear in a consistent story might be if this is what's going on in the boundary hologram and you have some supergravity dual for it. So let me just stop with that.
Any questions? There are no any questions. We'll thank the speaker. We'll break for tea and we'll resume at 4:30.